Just as we start, Joel, Daniel, Maria, thank you very much for choosing Oceans. It is one of those really special songs for me. So special I sometimes can't sing it. In fact, Susan definitely can't sing it. So she thinks, how can that be? Not God wants it. I'm going to need three volunteers to read some passages. No. Adults this time, please. There are other bits you can probably can help me read, though. Okay, so three volunteers. Yeah, I knew that you think we're in Exodus 14, mm-hmm. and it'll be verses 10 to 18.
Okay.
A second volunteer. Okay. Oh, Abby. If you could do Joshua 3:15. Joel, can you find... Oh, let me find my notes. It's Psalm. Let's go. Psalm 139, verses 2 to 3. Okay? There'll be some other verses as well, which you can have some volunteers at that time. But those three, you need to have your fingers in those passages. Right. Haven't you seen this slide before?
No.
No, you haven't.
It's been doctored.
There are two changes to it. What two changes? Can you spot the differences? Go on.
Session 5?
No, yeah, well, that was in the original one anyway. But there are two other changes. Yeah, go on, Sam.
The title?
Well, the title that was given, that's the one I was given. There are two other things still to find. Yeah, go on. Yes! Well spotted. That's the new Navigator logo for the UK. And the other obvious one would have been my name, wouldn't it? Now, this is just a bit of fun, but at the same time, there's a bit of a principle behind this. If you have been a believer for a while, and you've read through the Bible various times, sometimes you forget to notice things. Okay? So, how about this one? Anything different on that one? Aaron. Sorry.
That's him.
The Navigator's logo. Great. Good. You're awake.
Can't see it very well.
No, you can't see them. What, the point being, as you read through passages, sometimes please try it. You have to make a conscious decision to try and pay attention and notice things. There's a passage in Isaiah where God says, I want to do new things. Do you notice? And often, actually, honestly, nope, missed that one. Can we do it again? So, as we look at these passages that may well be quite familiar, have that thought in the back of your mind of actually, well, is there anything else new to notice? Okay? This, I just put in as a reminder, as a quick summary of what we've been talking about so far. So the first session was about thirst, second one was about idolatry, third one about sustenance and drinking deeply, the fourth one was suffering, and you've got the title for this talk, which is Faith Getting Your Feet Well. Now, I have to say that is a title that I was given. I'm not sure it's the best one that fits what I've actually going to say. So you can decide on that later. Right. Ooh, the wrong way.
You're going right.
Ha ha! Somebody also helpfully told us that water appears in different ways. I'm going to move over here a bit now. So on the one hand, water is used in the Bible to describe God's blessing. It is interesting that if you read some of the other commentaries and stuff, actually waterless places is very much associated with the lack of blessing. In fact, demons. In some cases. Oh, sorry, you're pointing that thing at me. A second one is often people talk about cleansing and washing. Yes, it does. And actually then you get a huge topic of sanctification, what that actually means. A third one, how many times are we talking about blessing, baptism, water baptism, as a sign and a symbol of repentance and new birth, but also pointing towards spiritual baptism too. And then the fourth big block of stories to do with water are to do with faith adventures. And that's where we're going to focus today. Now, let's start with Moses and the Israelites and their exodus from Egypt. I'm assuming you've already read quite a bit about Moses. Yeah? So what kind of things stand out from your current knowledge already about Moses? What was he like? What happened to him? Maybe not the other Sam go first, shall we? Sam? Yeah, that happens to most people. Okay.
He was very humble and was the meekest man on earth.
You reckon?
He was very shy.
You reckon?
Well, they got his brother to speak for him.
He got his brother to speak for him. That is certainly true. Any other thoughts?
Talked with God.
He did talk with God. Yes, he did. He did. He had big arguments, actually. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway. The thing I wanted to pick up were perhaps that, don't forget, he grew up in a privileged context, you know, in the Pharaoh's palace, with the Pharaoh's daughter basically being mum. Sneakily, his sister Miriam managed to find the Hebrew midwives. Actually got his mum to be able to go and look after him when he was a baby, which is good. He was also quite concerned about justice, but it sometimes would lead him into some difficult situations, shall we say. So he was wandering around the main Pharaoh's city and he sees an injustice, particularly against the Hebrew slave. He'd actually kept his own Hebrew identity secret, actually, but he then murders this Egyptian guy. And he thinks nobody noticed. Reaction? What's his response? Run! He was about 40 when he ran from Egypt. And he spent 40 years hiding in the Midian desert. He actually abandoned his wife. He was actually previously married to an Egyptian lady, which actually his sister told him a lot about. There's an argument in Numbers. I don't know whether this guy was a meek guy, or a timid guy, or a faithful guy at this stage in his life. At this stage in life, I wonder if there's perhaps a bit more fear and a bit more impulsiveness sort of happening in there. But there is this passion for injustice in correcting that, which is interesting. Initially, when God commanded him from the burning bush, I couldn't find any good pictures that I could actually borrow for free, so you've got to do these cartoon ones. You're right, he didn't really respond perhaps the way that God would have hoped. Again, it might have been fear. He didn't believe that if God sent him to Egypt, back to Egypt, that the other Israelites would actually believe him with his stories. And certainly the thought of going and talking to Pharaoh, a different Pharaoh by now, by the way. No, he wasn't very happy with that, was he? He said, yeah, I'll go, but send Aaron to do the talking for me. And then there are the 10 plagues, too. So, I mean, this is the earlier part of the stories that the Bible gives about Moses. And somebody the other day said about the staff, I think, and picking up by the tail. If you put a staff down, it turns to a snake. Most people handling snakes pick them up behind the head, because you don't want them to have space, the possibility to come back and bite you. So, just really weird, strange stories. Thing is, strange stories, thousands of years ago, we're talking 4,000 years ago, roughly, because it's 2,000 to Jesus, and actually about 2,000 before. Why? Did these things really happen? What relevance do they have for now? These are the kind of questions a lot of people ask. But the main thing for today, we're going to focus on Moses and the Red Sea. Now, this is some of the verses from Exodus 13. And without spending time on all the arguments and attempts to get people, the Israelites, to be able to leave Egypt, they didn't even then take the shortest route to the promised land. It says that God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, even though it was shorter. For God said, if they, the Israelites, face war, they might change their mind and go back to Egypt. So God led the people round by the desert road towards the Red Sea. Now, what did I say at the beginning about deserts and waterless places?
Demonic.
So, I mean, between we 25, 26 people this weekend, we'd have different ideas about going to the desert and all that kind of thing. There's about a million people behind Moses here. I mean, there must have been lots of murmuring going on. Where is he taking us? Who does he think he is? To make it even worse, by verse 20 it says, after leaving this place, Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. So how can following God's chosen leader moves you into this barren world? That's the possibility the demons are. Weird stuff. Okay, moving on quickly with the story. Pharaoh, having let them go, decides he's going to change his mind. He sends the army, the chariots, which was really high-tech stuff for that era, to chasing after them and caught up with them, so that the Israelites were trapped, basically. Water, impassable water on one side, and a murderous army chasing them on the other side. So God's leading with Moses has led them into this, I don't know how you'd call it, tough place. Isaac, can you read the next bit?
And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there are no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone for that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen.
Thank you. So, what do you think about the people's response to Moses leading? Were they happy? Not exactly. Did they think he'd slightly gone and lost it a bit? I think so. And Red Sea, why is it called Red Sea? Any ideas?
Sea of Reeds.
That's one idea. It's so long ago, people have forgotten. But their ideas about it being should have been Reed Sea. Yeah. What else? Any others? Others say cyanobacteria. Turns to waterbed. Others say coral reefs. Reefs. They're red. Or reflections from the mountain makes the water look red. There's a whole load of things going on there, but everybody focuses on the word read. Look at the word that comes after it.
Seas.
Yeah. So it's not a river. It's not a marshy bit. It's actually described as sea. I wonder where they actually crossed. Again, nobody knows. There's tons of discussions about where they actually crossed. Right on the very top part of a little branch of the Red Sea, or right at a lower bit, or in the middle, or there's all kinds of ideas out there. Who knows? But, is it, Vicky, Victoria, you said the other day about, did it seem harsh the way that God responded to people or something? Yeah, the verse 15 was here about, then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? I've told you what to do, get on with it, just go. Harsh. Also, I really wonder what if Moses knew what God was going to do. Just wonder. Amazing. Now, for me, like I said, I get bored. And so sometimes I find it helpful that there are other ways of approaching the same kind of information. One of the things I found helpful in these kind of stories is actually a book by a guy called Derek Williams. It's called The Bible Chronicle. And he tries to write about the events of with happening in scripture and in that similar events at the same time periods, more like a newspaper, a media story. Okay? Here we go. Headline. So the Israelites walked through on dry land, scripture says. The Egyptians pursued them. God got involved and caused confusion. Chariots didn't go over very well. They got bogged down, it says. And then Moses raised his staff again. The waters returned to normal. And the water was sufficient to drown the whole Egyptian army. All the men, all the horses, wash away all the chariots. This is not some very shallow, puddly bit. Interesting. In all that, it was such a key, significant event for the Israelites that time and time again, later passages refer back. Remember God when, remember when God did this. Remember when God led the people out of Egypt. And so, there we go. In Hebrews 11, it says this. That by faith, the people passed through the Red Sea, as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried, they were drowned. A couple of key questions are going to be repeated in this talk. First one, in looking at the story, how, where do you see faith in God expressed? That's what I said about looking at detail, noticing if you can. And then the other key question is, so what? You know, what's the relevance for us today? Those are the questions that I'm going to have repeated as we go through the stories. I have to say I am fascinated about how faith and feelings relate to each other. And why I wonder whether while sometimes we're excited, motivated, even passionate about things, it seems easy to make decisions based on faith. But when things are hard, and we're struggling, we're doubting, then maybe faith seems harder too. So I wonder how much seeing God's faithful working in the hearts of the Israelites and in Pharaoh, I wonder how that helped Moses in terms of trusting God. And I wonder how Moses' faith then impacted the people around him. His brother Aaron, sister Miriam, the wider family, that all the people of Israel who are looking to him for leadership. I kind of wonder how the ripples of his faith how far they would have reached. That was Moses. Now, back to the headlines. Joshua and the River Jordan. The verse I asked somebody to read would be Joshua 3:15. Have you? No.
And when those who carried the ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of the harvest, the waters which were flowing down from above and rose up in one heap, a great distance away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those which were flowing down towards the Sea of Araba and the Salt Sea were completely cut off, so the people crossed opposite Jericho.
Thank you. Now, crossing stretches of water on dry land can seem very unreal. Not likely to happen. By the time of this stage in the history, Joshua has taken over leadership as the Israelites from Moses. They have moved into the lands east of Jordan and had a whole pile of victories and kind of taken land and allocated it to various people. Then they come heading back westwards and then come to the Jordan. The Jordan near Jericho is in a ravine. It's a steep place with lots of fast-moving water. You're not going to do much easy crossing there. As the passage said, when the priest came now carrying the ark, started to walk into the water, the water stopped running and backed up. And then the priests carrying the ark went first, they went into the middle. All the people following then crossed the river on dry land. The priests go on and the waters flow back. Now, crossing the water on dry land in anybody's life is not going to happen very often. I mean, there aren't many people going to experience that. Joshua did it twice. Because he was one of the younger leaders who crossed the Red Sea with Moses. Here, he's about 45, 50 years old. He'd been one of the 12 spies that Moses had sent into the Promised Land to spy it out. He was one of the only two who thought, God's big enough, he can do this, we can sort this out, take this land. It's fascinating just wondering what impact crossing the Red Sea might have had for Joshua now leading the people. His turn. Which is why in the studies I asked you to have a think about comparing, contrasting what happened at the Red Sea and what happened in the Jordan. One or two things that you said that you may have noticed, any suggestions that you could share?
I felt like the Moses crossing, there were more of a sense of urgency and fear.
Yep.
Because the Egyptians were pursuing them and they literally just left slavery. Whereas for Joshua's, they were advancing to take the Promised Land.
Excellent, Abigail, yeah.
Yeah, and they had the ark and it was much more of a step out in faith with the water still flowing.
Yep.
And
yes, they had to take the first step.
Yeah, they had to take the
before
first
God actually did anything with the water. Yeah. Anybody else? One more thought?
There's a slight difference in the kind of scale and nature of the water as well. I mean, in one case you've got this enormous sea, and yeah, in the other case you've got a fast flowing river. And so it's kind of the nature of the two. One's kind of a parting of a full body of water, whereas the other it kind of stops. It just stops flowing.
That's what it sees, that's how it's described, isn't it? I mean, in one sense, it is so long ago, who actually really knows? Don't know. But it's fascinating just this wonder. Ask the question of how did Joshua's first experience then preparing us partly for the second experience, even if it was 45, 50 years later. These are some of the things that I put listed. Moses was about escape, as you said. So it was about the Red Sea, it was unexpected, it was escape, it was slavery and loneliness was a general characteristic of the people. They were leaving poverty and hardship, and at this point, they were people. Bit of a ramshackle, struggling kind of bunch of people, loosely connected. By the time we get to Joshua, now this is from moving from east of Jordan into Canaan, crossing the River Jordan, as you said, Joel, this is now intentional. There's a very different mindset to it. This is about entry into the promised land, so there's a hope and an expectation that they actually now have for this time. And they're coming with as settlers and warriors. And with the expectation that the promised land would be a land flowing with milk and...
honey.
Thank you. And how big were the grapes?
Size of your fist.
Exactly. Huge grapes. Not these little piddly things we tend to accept. And this is where that Hebrew struggling bunch becomes basically considered as a nation. So there are differences in terms of individuals, and there's differences collectively. You've probably found some other thoughts. And again, you know, what the so what? What are the questions? Anyway, now, Sea of Galilee. Ah, a beautiful place when it's calm. Rolling hills, some quite steep actually. Calm waters. Glorious sunsets. Where could be a nicer place? Even than here. Perhaps. The Gospels talk a lot about Galilee, fishing boats. I mean, there's plenty of stories, fishermen, fishing boats. Here's what people kind of thought the boats looked like. About 8 metres long, nearly 2.5 metres wide, about 1.5 metres high. Then you had a mast with sails, you had a bit of some oars. It has a bit of a look like the Viking ship, actually. Somebody decided to build a replica. So it does actually remind me of the Viking boat on the corner. Carries about 15 people. So 12 disciples plus Jesus, that's 13, yeah, that's within the 15. For us, we'd need two boats, wouldn't we? So that's kind of what people are thinking about the boat that Peter and the disciples are in when we get to the walking on the water story. Now this story is mentioned in three of the different Gospels. Generally, they're agreeing about the same, but some they add different little details in. And that's why I said at the beginning, watch out for the details, because sometimes they're quite intriguing. And the Gospels are written very intentionally. It's not just a novel that's been put together. They are stories, collections, written in a particular way to communicate a particular message. And there are all kinds of things where you ask the question, you know, it says therefore, what's therefore? Therefore. So this, when you see details given, you really should stop and ask, so what? Why are they given that detail? Okay? This incident follows what story?
Feeding of the 5,000.
Okay. And have you ever thought what that looked like?
Pretty vast. People.
I kind of, well, the first day I came here, I was looking from the attic out across the fjord, and then on the right hand side, there's a green little hill thing with some houses and stuff on it. And I kind of went, yeah, if it was ever a bit like that, you know, greeny, a few people, would that have been big enough for 5,000 people, 5,000 men, plus women, children? I don't know. Anyway, the disciples had a busy day. Jesus had fed 5,000 people from what resource?
Two fish and five.
And how much rubbish that the disciples then have to go and collect little baskets. So, after a day like that, how would you have been feeling?
Knackered. Like me now, pretty much.
Yeah. Confused. Where did that food come from? Who had a secret Amazon delivery?
Emotionally exhausted as well.
Exactly, yeah. So, what's it tell? It tells in the story about how, after all that busy day, Jesus seemingly kindly tells his disciples, okay, get in the boat, go on, head home. Head across the sea and go home. I'll take care of sending all the people away. He's also going to take time to go up a mountain and pray. Well, that's what Jesus does, isn't it? It says that the disciples got in the boat. And we're alone until the evening. Now, it sounds like that's probably kind of late afternoonish then that they set off. And the next bit of information we get is the boat was 3 miles, that's 5 to 6 kilometres away from the shore. Now, to give you a bit of a feel for that, if you look out the window down the fjord, Ulf and I agree that we think 5-6 kilometres is where the fjord seems to narrow from both sides. Okay, can you see the narrowing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. The four thoughts we'll pick up afterwards. This is a picture I took a couple of days ago. Looking down there, looking at that narrowing. Can you see the boat? Any better?
Yeah.
Okay, you see it?
Mm-hmm.
So if the disciples were that far away when Jesus looked out at them, just to give you an idea, anything else that's significant about 3 miles, 5 to 6 kilometres?
It's no short distance.
No, it's no short distance. Sorry?
It'll be quite a long walk as well.
Be quite a long walk as well, yeah. Anything else? Any scientists?
It's back in water, isn't it?
No. What shapes the Earth? Round, yes. And what happens when you get more than 3 miles or 5 or 6 kilometres away? If you're up ground, you know, sea level.
Can you see the curvature?
The curvature of the Earth begins to affect the horizon. Yeah. Yeah. The fact that Jesus could see them and knew what was going on. Oh, by the way, what did it say? It was a storm, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a nice day out today, rowing, sailing that far might be okay, but they set off late afternoon and by the fourth watch is about 3 to 6 o'clock in the early morning the next day. Busy day serving people, exhausted emotionally, out in the, on the storm, on the lake, in effectively a storm, waves, wind. You've been trying to sail the boat for hours. Say, I don't know, from 6 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe. Your hike up the mountain to the back here was a 7-hour thing. These guys were, it does say they're struggling. I think that's a bit of an understatement. If you'd been in the boat, if the fishermen among you, Peter, James, John, probably would have been, we're fine, guys, yes, we're okay, they can't show any problems, can they? But Matthew, come on, the tax collector, not been in a boat much. I mean, poor guy. And then on top of that, when you're physically and emotionally exhausted, you get this weird thing coming towards you across the water. What are you going to do? How comfortable are you going to feel? are you going to say, oh, ignore that, it's not important? I mean, I would really want to know, did Jesus get his feet wet? Or is he just gliding along, you know, like a hovercrafty thing? Or was he actually going splash, 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 splash? I don't know. Fascinating. Details we don't have. But then he says, what? Yeah. Because?
They thought he was a ghost.
Well, I think that that's one reason. Because this is a weird thing. I have no clue what's going on, and that can be quite scary, making you feel afraid. And the fact that, I mean, they've just been battling a storm for hours. I'm sure they're fairly exhausted. We're never going to go home. Oh, what's going to happen? Now. Ah, hang on. Oh, yes. The passage in Psalm 139, please.
2-3.
Yeah.
You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways.
As I was thinking about Jesus looking out at the disciples struggling over there, it'd probably be quite hard to see them if they're up and down in the waves and stuff. But the fact it made me think of these verses about God knowing where we are at, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and understanding us really, really well. Did you read it again?
You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar.
Roughly 3 miles away.
You discern my going out, my lying down. You're familiar with all of my ways.
Thank you. You put those two together, I think that suddenly changes about, they're not on their own at all. They felt very much on their own, but they actually weren't. And they certainly were not beyond God's help. So, here we go. Getting to the key part, I suppose. Peter. Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water. Come, he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand, caught him. You of little faith, why did you doubt? right. I wonder how he managed to get out of the boat if it's in the middle of the storm. He can't just sit on the edge and push himself off. Yeah? But reading through this a bit more seriously, what words stand out perhaps for you?
Tell me.
Yeah? Why does that stand out?
He's asking Jesus specifically to tell him, not them, me, like the individual.
Okay.
And then also Jesus says, come, which I think is like, it's like come here. It's like,
is this like, Jesus, can I come and join you?
He's trying to prove.
Or is it, if you tell me to come, I'll obey. I think it's worth just reflecting a little bit on how you think these words would have been said. I think the other key word is actually the little one if. So many times if means there's about 4 different ways you can use if. But if it's you, tell me to come. So there's questions of doubt. There's questions, all kinds of questions in there. And Jesus did reply. He said, come. Why did Peter then suddenly think about the wind? These are questions to talk about later. Why did he suddenly think about the wind? But I think the key bit, though, is what was Jesus' response? But immediately, Jesus reached out. It wasn't, Okay, I'll wait for you to come down, go down under the water for the tenth time, and then I'll rescue you. It wasn't any other condition put on. It's basically, Peter called out, and Jesus immediately responded with saving him. A slight bit of a rebuke as well. Why did you doubt? Why did I doubt? Because nobody ever else has done this in the world, ever. I think it would have been a reasonable response from Peter, but anyway. So again, the same two questions. From this story, thinking about Peter, thinking about the other disciples who were in the boat, where do you see God, faith in God expressed? And again, so what? What are the lessons for us? Now, we're looking at these stories because I think actually there is something here that matters to each of us. Sometimes it's as though Jesus asks us to get out of the boat, to leave a comfort zone as part of our own spiritual journey with him, our own spiritual growth even. But then, you know, how willing or eager are we to step out onto the water, to get out of the boat, to leave the comfort zone? Are we going to be like Peter, who sometimes seems so impulsive, and there are full commentaries full of, was he being his normal impulsive sense, self, or was it some other reason? Or would we have been one of the other 11 in the boat, just keeping quiet or hanging on to the sides? I don't know. But the question of what also helps us or hinders us. Steve had mentioned this book. An American preacher, author, pastor. The boat is a safe, secure, comfortable. On the other hand, the water's rough, the waves are high, the wind is strong, there's a storm out there. If you get out of the boat, you might possibly sink. Even there's a good chance of it. Is that what we're thinking? I think two things perhaps to get your heads around a little bit is to, again, think about what encourages and discourages us. Now, whether we get our feet wet or not, I'm not really sure that is the thing, the actual point, really, because we heard about how things people walked on dry land. But two sources, I think, can really encourage us. One is Bible passages, these stories that have been used and repeated time and 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 time again, but also people's own personal stories and testimonies. And I have to say, these last few days with you guys has been very special for me, hearing the stories that you've shared. And that's part of why it's important to share what God has been doing in each of our lives. For me, these are some of my key verses, and you'll probably have your own. It'll be interesting in the discussion groups to kind of share other verses that you think are helpful. For me, 1 Corinthians 1:25 says, "The foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength." In other words, God's different. His perspective is different. What I can see partly, he sees fully. And I think being willing to say, I can see this, but I also know this is not the whole story. There's more to what's going on. Another one would be Romans 12. One and two, you've probably memorized this, or at least part of it. "I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Now, keep it. Do not conform to the pattern of the world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind." The first bit, actually, living sacrifice, is interesting, because most sacrifices are dead. Little detail, small thing. This is actually a different kind of sacrifice. It's not. It is about letting go of control, but it's about letting go of your control in order to have God take control. It's about not being limited to our human things, but actually widen the whole thing to God's perspective. Then there's that transformation word. Greek is metamorphio. All the scientists will have learned about the insects and the life cycle of caterpillars into butterflies and eventually all that kind of stuff. That's the same word that they use, metamorphosis. So it's not about a superficial change. This is not about just tweaking things. This is talking about a deep change. So effectively, it looks very different now as a redeemed believer. Right, we're nearly at the end. I did put the three questions on there, but we can leave that one quickly because I'll put it back again. Now, I said, this is a quote that Steve gave. Get out of the boat, face your fears, fail, learn, adjust, try again, and watch God do more than you can imagine. Oceans. The song Oceans. We're going to play it again, but just listen and put yourself into the story. These are questions. The top two are the main discussion questions. The third one, you can, you need to be thinking about whether you share it in your group. That's up to you to decide. And I think I'd ask you to put a fourth question in about what you think I should have called this talk. Anyway, that's over to you guys.